We come now in our survey of the Bible to the book of Daniel and the way people divide the Bible. Daniel is the final of the last of the so-called major prophets. I've always found it an interesting division because Daniel has 12 chapters and one of the... Well, actually, more than one of the so-called minor prophets have more chapters than Daniel does, so I don't know why they're classified as minor. We'll talk about more about that in the days to come, but Daniel is the last of the so-called major prophets, but what a major prophet this is. For me, Daniel is the heart of the Old Testament. This is a book, and I don't know, maybe some of you looking at your bulletin may have said, Daniel is the book of the kingdom. Duh. How dull that sounds. Well, it probably does sound dull, but there's nothing dull about the book of Daniel. Even for our little ones in Sunday school, some of the greatest stories of the Bible are found in the book of Daniel. But they are more than just stories, more than just things to fascinate us. They do, and they should, but the information packed into the book of Daniel, as I said or implied earlier, is more than we can survey. But we're going to do our best. And so this is the book, more than any other Old Testament book, about the kingdom. God's purpose in a kingdom. Now, in order to understand the book of Daniel, you have to go back to that principle that we've talked about earlier, and that is that Israel is the key to prophecy. And this book is not a book about the church. It has lots of application for us, but it's a book about Israel. And so the book divides very easily into two parts, the first six chapters and the last six chapters. And for those of you who like to take notes, there are five subpoints under the first heading. The first heading is, be a man of God. The second, see the plan of God. Learn the plan of God. See the plan of God. Be a man of God. And you understand I'm using, Daniel is a male, but we're using that term man in the generic sense of a human being, male or female. But be a man of God. And there are five things that I want us to see here in these six chapters. And not the least important is the very first thing in chapter one. It's the need for holiness. Now the word holy means to be separate. And Daniel and his three friends that we learn about, their names were Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, but the Babylonians gave all these guys Babylonish names. They wanted to convert them to be Babylonians. I'm not so much talking about religiously, although that was true too, but in their mindset, in their thinking, they were to become like the Chaldeans or the Babylonians, as we call them. And so, Daniel was given the name Belteshazzar, and Hananiah and Azariah and Mishael were called Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these names all reflected the gods of Babylon. Well, the point is that these men were taken to Babylon in the third or the final deportation. Ezekiel, whom we looked at last week, had been taken to Babylon in the first of the three deportations. And as we saw briefly recently, these men were aware of each other. Certainly Daniel was known to Ezekiel. And Jeremiah was known to Daniel, as we'll see in just a bit. But when these four guys got there, they made up their minds that they were going to follow the law of God to the best of their ability. And they got tested on it immediately. And that was when these guys were chosen to be the elite of the Chaldean kingdom, and they were to eat and drink from the king's table the foods that were prepared for Nebuchadnezzar. But many of these were prohibited according to the Mosaic law. And so Daniel went to the official who was responsible for them and said, we would like you to just give us vegetables to eat. And the official had to put himself on the line here, because if he didn't give them what had been prescribed and their health deteriorated, it was his head that would roll, maybe literally, over this. But he was impressed with Daniel and his three friends, and so he followed their prescription. Well, God honored that, and in the end, they were healthier than all the other guys that were part of this group. Now, in saying this, they were honored by God because they chose to follow God rather than man. And I want to bring something out to you here. Do you think that these four fellows, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, do you think these were the only four Jewish fellows in the group? I don't think so. I'll bet there were others who said to themselves, well, you know, I mean, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I'm jumping ahead a bit here, of course. But you're probably familiar with that phrase. When in Babylon, do as the Babylonians do, you know. And the at the time that this was all happening, the nation of Israel, Judah, was gone politically. Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple had been leveled. And so there was nothing left. There was nothing to go back to. And the Babylonians weren't going to let them go back. So you might as well just settle in and be like them and forget everything else. And many did, I'm sure. Is there a lesson here for Christians today? Yeah, if you want to be honored by God, be a holy person. And as I said a few minutes ago, you don't hear much about sin anymore. From pulpits or anywhere else, you don't hear much about holiness anymore. After all, if we're going to ignore sin, what is there to be holy about? But these four guys thought there was something to be holy about. And they did. And this is all going to come full circle in just a moment as we survey further. The second thing to note, and this is chapter 2, is to be a person of the Word of God. Now, we're familiar with chapter 2 because this is the great chapter, and it is a great chapter, about the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And he posed the question to his wise men. Not only did they have to interpret the dream, they had to tell him what the dream was. And I'm of two minds on this. I don't know if Nebuchadnezzar honestly could not remember what he dreamed. Have you ever had that? I have, where I had a vivid dream and then a few minutes after I woke up, I couldn't remember the details anymore. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar was serious about this. Or did he really remember what he had dreamed, and this was a test for these guys that were supposed to be the wise men and the astrologers and the soothsayers, and they supposedly had all this power? Well, they couldn't do anything. And Nebuchadnezzar decided he was going to get rid of these characters. I mean, he was supporting all these people, and they couldn't do anything for him. So he's going to get rid of them. They're all going to die. And Daniel finds out what is happening and requests time to consult his God and see if he could have the answer. And so he did, and he didn't pray by himself, he got his three friends to come. Why didn't he get six or a dozen or 20 or so of the Jews? Because these were the four men who had made a stand for holiness. And he knew that these other three fellows were dead serious about this matter. So they prayed, and God gave Daniel the answer. God told him the dream and the interpretation of the dream. And we looked at that with regard to our memory verse, Daniel 2:22. God is the one who knows the secret things and reveals them. Now, He's done the same for you, and it's in this book. He's revealed in this book everything we need to know. And God revealed to Daniel what he needed to know. Now, there was more to come, but this is what Daniel needed to know now. And he gave the dream and the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar, and keep in mind, this is the most powerful person in the world in his day. He has conquered everybody in sight. And God gives to Daniel the interpretation. And you know the story. Nebuchadnezzar saw a great statue. And the statue is made out of four different materials. And then he saw a stone that was cut out without hands. And it was hurled at the statue, and the statue collapsed. And the stone ground the statue to powder, and the wind blew the powder away. There's nothing left of the statue. And then the stone became a great mountain that filled the whole earth. What an unusual dream. I've never had a dream like that. My dreams are much more mundane than things like this. But it was a picture in advance of God's program of the ages, His plan of the ages. Now, the four countries that were involved, and they're not named initially in the scriptures, but since almost everything in that dream is history now, we know that the countries were Babylon and Persia and Greece and finally Rome. And why those four countries? After all, China was a great country at this stage of history. And India had a great... Why are they not mentioned? Why isn't the United States there? I get asked that all the time. Is the United States in the Bible? No. You want the short answer? It's N-O. No. We're not mentioned there. And the reason is because the only thing that's mentioned are those that have a direct impact on Israel. And by direct, I mean direct. And these empires did. And then for a time, there is no Israel. I mean, the land is still there, of course, but there's no nation of Israel. And the point is that Israel is the key to prophecy. You want to understand the Bible? You need to understand that God's program revolves around the nation of Israel. And so, you know, people get worried. I'm getting ahead of myself a bit here, but we might as well get this out of the way. People get worried. The United States isn't mentioned in prophecy. I guess the United States isn't here anymore. No, it doesn't mean that. It just means that we don't physically deal with the nation of Israel. We haven't conquered it. We're not going to. These sort of things. So no, it doesn't mean that the U.S. ceases to exist. It just means that in God's program, we're just one of the other Gentile nations. That's all. And I could say more about that, but again, this is a survey. All I can do is hit the highlights. So we move to chapter 3. And here, in being a man of God, not only is holiness needful and a love for the Word of God, and keep in mind, that's what Daniel got in chapter 2. He got a word from God. And that's all that mattered. Nothing else mattered. It was, I need a word from God. Do you ever need a word from God? Here it is. 66 books of a word from God. Find it there. How many times has it been true? I certainly can give testimony. Doubtless you can as well. When you needed a word from God, you found it right here. But now chapter 3, a person of faith. A person of faith. Now, this chapter says nothing about Daniel. Who it talks about is Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. But of course, we know them better as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and that's how we sing about them and everything else, and that's okay. But Nebuchadnezzar had this dream of a great statue, and guess what? And understand, Nebuchadnezzar is a pagan. He's a worshiper of false gods. He's not a Christian, all right? So what does he do? Well, he builds a great statue, and I'm sure it was built at least similarly to the pattern of his dream. And he demanded that everybody worship the statue. And if it had a face on it, and I assume it did, I would bet that it looked an awful lot like Nebuchadnezzar. Because Nebuchadnezzar had been told that the head of the statue in his dream was him. It represented him and his kingdom, his empire. And so he demanded that everybody worship. And of course, everybody did, except for these three guys. Now, where Daniel was, I don't know. Was he not around? That would be my guess, that he had been sent on a mission, or he was stationed somewhere else, and he wasn't there for this big ceremony, the unveiling of the great statue. Almost the size of an obelisk, if you look at the dimensions. But anyway, these three guys would not bow down and worship the statue. Again, I ask this question, are they the only three Jews in this ceremony? I doubt it very much. But they're the only three who wouldn't worship. They would not compromise. And in this chapter, the highlight is when they're brought before Nebuchadnezzar. And you have to understand, these three men have already been elevated to some high positions in the empire. So it's not like you and me being brought before him. People he doesn't even know. So he gives them a second chance. And he says, now we're going to play the music again. And if you enjoy reading about musical instruments, just read the several descriptions of all these musical instruments. I particularly like the one that's called a sackbut. But I have no idea what that is. But anyway, it's one of the instruments. And if you'll bow down, that's fine. But if not, you're going to be cast into the fiery furnace. And here's the highlight. They said to him, King, we don't need time to consider this. And I'm paraphrasing here. We've already considered it. And our God is able to deliver us out of your hand. But even if he doesn't, we still will not worship your statue. And so, you know the story. The furnace was heated 7 times hotter than it normally would be. And they were bound, so they couldn't fight or run away. And they were hurled into the furnace. And the furnace was so hot, and I could tell you stories from being a forest ranger, but the furnace was so hot that it killed the guys, the soldiers that threw them into the furnace. And apparently in the bottom of the furnace, you could see into it, and Nebuchadnezzar, I don't know if anybody else did, but Nebuchadnezzar saw, and you remember the story. I see those three men that had been bound, they're walking around free, and there's a fourth one with him, and he looks like the Son of God. And, of course, you can, if you want to argue the language and the terms and this sort of thing, you can argue it, but I think the King James has it right. It looks like the Son of God, because that's who it was. It wasn't just an angel. This was the pre-incarnate Christ that walked with them and protected them. And again, so many things to be said here. When they are called to come out of the furnace and they walk out, not only are they not singed or damaged in any way, they don't even smell like the smell of fire. And Nebuchadnezzar has an epiphany, if I can use that word. He realizes that, and he isn't a believer yet. I think he is by the end of the fourth chapter, but he isn't yet. But he recognizes and says, there is no God who can deliver like their God. Nobody can do this except the God that these men worship. And they're elevated again in their position. God honors their faith. They trusted Him even, and same kind of faith that Job had. You remember what Job said? Even though He slay me, yet will I trust in Him. That's what these three men had, and that's what you and I need to have. He will deliver, but even if He doesn't, we're going to remain faithful to Him. Number four, testimony. We need to be people of testimony. And Daniel was such a man. And in chapter 4, he gives his testimony to Nebuchadnezzar because Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. And he gets Daniel to give the interpretation. And this is not a very favorable dream. It's a warning that he needs to, and again, you'll pardon me for quoting my dad frequently, but after all, it is Father's Day. But my dad used to say, straighten up and fly right. And that was a warning to me that if you don't straighten up and fly right, there's going to be a problem. And Nebuchadnezzar had a problem. He had gotten so proud of himself. And small wonder that he did. One of the things, and we've talked about this, I'm sure, before, he built one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. He built an artificial mountain, and his engineers developed pumps to pump water to the top of the mountain and then let it cascade down through all this luxurious vegetation. And he did all this for his favorite wife. She was from the mountains of Persia and missed them, because the plain of Babylon is, flat as a plain. And she missed her mountains, and he made a mountain for her. So he had all this great Babylon. And he remembered what Daniel had warned him about for roughly a year. And then one day he said, I've done all this. Aren't I grand? And God struck him. And seven times passed over him, and he was what today would be called insane. You can read about this for yourself. But the point is, after God had chastened him, he was restored to his mind, and he had not lost his kingdom. Nobody had taken it over or anything. And by the way, how long a period was this? I don't know. Long enough for his nails to grow long and his hair to grow long and all this sort of thing. So it had to be a considerable length of time. And most of us would say 7 years passed. In any event, he is restored. And I believe from his testimony after his restoration that he became a believer in the one true God. Well, the fifth chapter is also a chapter of testimony. And it's also the testimony of the end of Babylon and the rise of the Persian Empire. Babylon is under siege at this time. Cyrus and his army of Persians have the city of Babylon under siege. And Belshazzar, who is the king of Babylon at this time, is so confident of withstanding the Persian siege that he has this great feast. Now, his grandfather, if we understand this correctly, was Nebuchadnezzar. And unlike his grandfather, who had brought all the holy vessels from the temple in Jerusalem to Babylon, had nevertheless respected the fact that these were holy vessels dedicated to the God Yahweh, or Jehovah. But his grandson, Belshazzar, did not consider that to be so, and he and his guests at this great feast used them as drinking vessels to get drunk with and all this sort of thing. He despised the holiness of these articles, and he saw a hand write on the wall, and it wrote in words that had a general familiarity but made no sense, I'll put it that way. And finally, the queen mother tells him about Daniel and that he ought to call Daniel. By the way, Daniel is no youngster anymore. But he calls Daniel and makes all these promises to him. And Daniel said, just keep all your honors and wealth and that sort of thing. But I'll tell you what it says. And if I can just sum up, you and your kingdom are going to die tonight. And that's what happened. We read, and it happened in history. You can read it apart from the Bible. But the Persian army entered the city of Babylon that night, killed Belshazzar, and became the rulers of the nation. But in both of these incidents, Daniel gives a testimony, and the testimony is you need to repent. Whether it's Nebuchadnezzar many years before or Belshazzar that night, here's what God says. And that's the kind of people we ought to be. Here's what God says. The wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Jesus Christ our Lord. That's our testimony. And then finally, chapter 6 in this section, this is point 5, a person of prayer. A person of prayer. And again, I come to this text where Daniel, in fact, if you would, look at chapter 6 and verse 10. This is the only part. We all know about the lions and the lion's den, and I'm not minimizing this. God sent his angel to shut the mouths of the lions, and Daniel was not harmed. And when the king threw Daniel's enemies into the lion's den, they didn't even make it to the bottom before they were dead, and because the lions had killed them. But here is what I think is fascinating. Let me read verse 10 again. Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber he had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. Now these people knew what Daniel's pattern was. And Daniel knew the ordinance had been signed, and I'm convinced he knew why the ordinance was put in effect. He knew it was against him, and he knew these guys knew. You know, you ever done that little game? He knew that he knew that he knew that he knew. Well, everybody knows what's going on here. Everybody except Darius, apparently. I don't know. It's hard to believe people can be that thick. But anyway, apparently he was, or easily flattered. But our point here is, Daniel, knowing all this, continued to do just like he always did. He prayed to his God. Now here's the other aspect of this. You can search the Bible high and low and not find any command, Mosaic law or New Testament or wherever you look, you cannot find any command that you have to pray 3 times a day. Now, the Bible enjoins us to pray and to be people of prayer. And we are to be, for example, Colossians chapter 4, we are to devote ourselves to prayer. But you won't find any place in the Bible that says you must morning, noon, night, 3 times a day. You find the example, but never the command that you have to do this. Now, if you were a Mohammedan, you're commanded to pray 5 times a day. And you are to kneel down and you're to face Mecca, as nearly as you can determine, and pray to Allah 5 times a day. But God never tells anybody to pray 3 times or however many times. Furthermore, there's nothing in the Bible that says you have to throw your windows open toward Jerusalem and direct your prayers that way. This was Daniel's devotion and his pattern. And did God lead him to do that? I'm convinced he did. But that was how God led Daniel. And Daniel, he didn't care how many laws were written against this. He was going to do it because that's what God directed him to do. Well, I don't know about you, but I find verse 10 a very convicting verse. You know, most of us pat ourselves on the back, so to speak, if we have devotions in the morning and spend a few minutes in prayer or read a verse or two, and we think we've done something great. I've mentioned this before, and it's old news. I don't know if it still stands, but and it was what I was told, the information I had was that this was done by the Southern Baptist Convention, and they surveyed a number of their preachers. How much time do you spend in prayer every day? And the preachers said, on average now, 2 minutes a day. 2 minutes a day. And if that was the average, it means some of them didn't pray at all, and a few prayed more than 2 minutes a day. But 2 minutes was the average. Do you think that's all the time Daniel spent? He couldn't have kneeled down three times a day and spent only 2 minutes. So our point here is, this guy was a man of prayer. And that's where it comes back full circle. Why was he a person of prayer? Why did he do this three times a day and determine that no matter what it cost him, he was going to continue to do this? Because he was a man of holiness. He had dedicated himself to God from the very beginning. And I don't know when he started the three times a day pattern or windows toward Jerusalem or anything like that. I don't know how long he had been doing this, but he'd been doing it a long time. And my point through all of this is that because he had determined that he was going to be separated to God, he ended up a man of prayer. This kind of prayer. I don't mean a man who prays once in a while. I mean a man devoted to prayer. And if you want more on that, you can ask me after the service. I've got some personal words for that. But we have to move on. I've spent too much time on being... No, I haven't. We haven't spent enough time on being a man of God. But we must move on to seeing the plan of God. And I suggest to you that the order of these chapters and the order of what we're told in the book of Daniel is a divine order. Because unless you become a person of God, you're not going to see the plan of God. You're not going to understand it. And so, I have 6 points to make here. Chapter 7, and this is easy for us to cover in synopsis. Chapter 7 is about four beasts. And interestingly enough, they correspond to the four types of metals that were found in Nebuchadnezzar's image. Now, and they convey the same information, essentially, about four empires or kingdoms that are going to arise that have direct impact on the nation of Israel. So why does God do this again? I mean, after all, we've already got Nebuchadnezzar's vision, dream. Why this vision? Because in this one, you're seeing it from the divine perspective. Nebuchadnezzar's vision was of the statue of a man. And so it's from the earthly perspective that we see. But here, we see how God sees these four kingdoms. And they're not seen as precious metals or seen as man-type things. They're seen as animals. Weird, strange animals. Winged lions. And to me, the strangest, aside from the fourth, which can't even be described, but the fourth is a leopard with four wings and four heads. Whoever saw such a thing? People had seen leopards and lions and bears before, but never like these. And then the fourth beast, the Roman beast, is one that for which there is no comparison. There's a little bit of description given, but it can't be compared to anything. And so the point is that God sees human works and efforts in a far different way than we see them ourselves. And then, and this is tongue-in-cheek, but I couldn't help myself, I named chapter 8 Little Bighorn. And this is, again, we see two strange animals. But one of them is a goat, with the horns of a goat, and then a third horn, a little horn, comes up on the head of this beast, and it has a mouth that speaks great things. And this is a prophecy that has one fulfillment, but two aspects to it. And the main aspect, as far as Daniel is concerned, keep in mind, when Daniel is writing these prophecies down, it's all future to him. Most of this is history to us, but for him it was all future. And this little horn, boasting horn, is in the first place a reference to a man who's coming up out of this Greek or Alexandrian Empire, who is known to history as Antiochus Epiphanes. And he, more than any other, is an enemy of the nation of Israel. But he's just a foreshadowing of the ultimate enemy, the Antichrist, of whom we'll say more later. We come to chapter 9 now, and this is the chapter of the 70 weeks. And if there's one chapter, none of these chapters are unimportant, but if there's one more important than another, it is this, because it's in this chapter that God gives us the outline of his program for the nation of Israel, and it has to do with 70 weeks. Now, I keep using the word weeks because that's what you find in your King James and even in modern translations. Many of them still say weeks, but the original language simply says 77s, 490 of some unit of time. Now, because most of this for us is history, it's easy to see what the units of time are. They're years. And so 490 years brings to fulfillment God's program for Israel. But they're not all consecutive years. The first 69 weeks are consecutive. And explanation is given here, and it takes us up to the coming of Messiah and his being cut off and having nothing. And then the city of Jerusalem is destroyed. Keep in mind, when Daniel is writing, the city of Jerusalem has already been destroyed. But this implies that it's going to be rebuilt again and that there will be a temple again. But the people of the prince who is to come are going to destroy the city and the sanctuary. So there's going to be another destruction. And then, that's the end of the 69th week. 483 years, is my math right? All right. And then there's a gap of time. And then the 7th week begins, the final week, 70th, I'm sorry. The final week begins with the prince who is coming, and this is the Antichrist, the prince who is coming making a covenant, a treaty with the nation of Israel for 7 years. And in the midst of the years, he breaks his treaty and tries to destroy the Jewish people. And the point is that this is the timeline for God's prophetic program. And this is the only place in the Bible that we have that timeline. But God has outlined it for us. And good men of God, better than me, certainly, have gone through with the mathematics and all that sort of thing. And I'm thankful for them. I couldn't do it. But in any event, here we have it, the 70 weeks. All right, the last three chapters of the book of Daniel. Chapter 10 is about spiritual warfare. And here is where Daniel is involved with prophecy. In chapter 9, he discovers, I didn't mention this, but in chapter 9, he's reading the writings of Jeremiah. He is reading the scrolls that have Jeremiah's prophecies, and he discovers that 70 years are the time of the Babylonian captivity, and he prays because that time is almost up. So Daniel has to be in his 80s when this revelation comes, and now in chapter 10 he's praying again, And he's praying for 3 weeks before he gets the answer. You ever prayed about something for 3 weeks? Well, I have. A lot longer than 3 weeks, but then I'm not Daniel. He prays for 3 weeks, and then an angel comes to give him the answer. And the angel tells him that he started out when Daniel first began to pray, but he was opposed by the prince of Persia, and the prince of Greece is coming, and this sort of thing. You think an angel can be stopped for 3 weeks by a couple of human beings? No, no. The princes that are involved there are spiritual princes. They're fallen angels, demonic spirits. And that's what's going on around us, but we don't see it. And because we walk by sight so much more than we do by faith, we just ignore it. But this is what spiritual warfare is. By the way, you could learn so much of this if you took the Mailbox Club lessons, particularly if you persevere into Course 3. But in Course 3, one of the things that George pointed out in the lesson on prayer is that intercessory prayer is spiritual warfare. It's not casting out demons and the things that everybody gets worked up about. Spiritual warfare is praying against the powers of darkness. That's what we do when we intercede for others. Well, in any event, he learns much, and you and I can learn much, from the 10th chapter of Daniel. Chapter 11, the fifth point that we want to look at here, I've just called the little Antichrist. By the way, this 11th chapter of Daniel is the one that drives the critics crazy, because this is so detailed. And Sarah and I have been studying this together on Fridays for a while. And I even had to come up, and it wasn't just for us, I'd done this for other groups too, but with a separate set of notes that correlate all the details of chapter 11 with the historical people who fulfilled these things. Again, for Daniel, it's all future. But for you and for me, it's past history, and we can see the people that fulfilled the prophecies of chapter 11. The critics go crazy because even they recognize that this is too detailed and corresponds too accurately with historical events for it to be other than a divine revelation of the future. And they've already rejected that concept. So their only conclusion is it must have been written after the events, and it wasn't the historical Daniel who wrote these things. But even there, they have a problem, because the language that he uses is the old language, not the new language of the time after these events took place. So the point is, God revealed to Daniel what the future was going to hold. And the 11th chapter culminates with a reference once again to this character called Antiochus, and how he prefigures, foreshadows, the ultimate Antichrist who is yet to come. And we've had lots of these little Antichrists down over the years. We'll go back in the Bible, just pick one, Haman in the days of Esther. He was a little Antichrist, wanted to eradicate the Jewish people. All those down through history who have wanted to eradicate the Jews have been little Antichrist. John, in 1 John chapter 2, says, this is how we know we're in the last time. Already, you've heard that Antichrist is coming, and already little Antichrists are abroad. And we had, and I know that the 6 million Jews that perished among the Nazis in World War II wouldn't have considered Hitler little, but he was, compared to the one that's coming, another little Antichrist, a foreshadowing of what is to come. Well, that's what we have in chapter 11. And finally, number 6, the final conflict, chapter 12. And here we read that at that time, Michael, the prince who is... let me read how it says here. The prince who stands guard over your people. Michael the archangel is most especially the one who looks out for the benefit, the welfare of the people of Israel. He will stand up. You can read about this in the book of Revelation. But he will stand up in defense of the people. But it's Messiah's return that brings all of this to its conclusion. And so the 12th chapter of Daniel brings us to what is yet future for you and me. Now, final word here before we look to the end of the book, and it's this. Up to this point, Daniel has never been told to seal up anything that's been revealed to him. But at this point, God says to Daniel, seal up this prophecy, because it's for the days yet to come. Now, I pointed out that as Daniel gets these prophecies, they're all future for him, but this one is way future. And he says, you know, the things you've heard about the coming kings and the conflicts over the nation, you don't have to seal that up. That's coming. Not in your lifetime, but successively. But this conflict in chapter 12 is for far in the future. So just seal that up. It's not for right now. But in the day that it's needed, it will be understood. And I think people in this day have come to understand. Not everybody by any means. Not every Christian by any means. But many have come to understand. I don't mean just in the year 2017 or the 21st century, but for 100 and more years now, a couple hundred years, there have been discerning men and women who have understood what is being written here. And you're privileged as well to live in that day. Well, this is the kingdom of God, what God plans for the future. And I hope that you can rejoice in it and be a man of God. And when you are, you'll be able to see the plan of God as well. I'm going to ask Sheila and Andrew if they'll come. And we'll close our meeting this morning with another hymn, Dare to Be a Daniel. And I don't know if that's familiar to you. You know, it was sung in Sunday school quite a bit. In days gone by, hopefully you'll pick it up very quickly. Dare to be a Daniel.